This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week's episode is going to be another twofer. That is that I've got a couple of people who are going to be on this podcast. And at the end of the podcast, we have 20 minutes of an audio short story that was written by John Gaspard that is called The Last Customer. This is an exclusive just only for the Magic Word Podcast. You will not hear this anyplace else. He had this recorded and didn't know what to do with it except just to offer it to us and to the listeners. And so I want to thank John very much for making this available. Now, because this is going to be a little extended, I'm going to be very brief up front here just to introduce these two back-to-back speakers. The first is Greg Corin, who had recently written a book entitled The Memory Trap. And this is really directed towards young readers. Let me back up just a little bit to say that the reason that we are talking with these authors is that these are not magic books from the standpoint where they teach magic. Not at all. I mean, these kinds of books come out in our magic community all the time. And the purpose of this podcast is not necessarily to promote books written by magicians all the time, unless it happens to be in the context just of our conversation. But these are some things I think that need to be brought to your attention. And again, the first one here with Greg Corin, which is directed towards young readers, is also directed towards the parents of young readers, so that he encourages the parents to actually read these stories of his to their children. So this is really an entertaining book, something I would recommend, and deserves your attention. And the second, we're going to be talking with John Gaspard, and John is not only a friend of the Magic Word, but he is someone who you have heard in previous episodes of the Magic Word podcast, where he has talked about his magician detective, Mr. Eli Marks, and it's a fun series. And if you have not heard any of those or read any of the books, again, they are on Kindle. He has hard copies as well as audiobooks available through Amazon. And I would recommend that you read those. And so if you haven't, you can jump right in with his newest book he's going to be talking about here today, which is called The Zombie Ball. It's going to be released on August the 27th. Today is being released on August the 22nd, but it's going to be another 5 days from now whenever that they'll be releasing this officially. But the other book of Greg Corin's is already available in the Amazon store, but the hard copy will soon be available, hopefully by the end of the month, from what he tells me. So anyhow, as I said, these are my brief comments, you know, up front. So we're going to be talking first with Greg Corin, and then we'll be talking to John Gaspard, and then you'll be hearing after that the 20-minute audio of The Last Customer. One last thing, which I'll talk about after you hear The Last Customer, is how that you can enter a contest to win a free copy, a free ebook of one of these books, either The Memory Trap or The Zombie Ball. So, right now, please welcome my guest, Mr. Greg Corin, here on The Magic Word.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com. And today we're going to be going in a little bit different direction from the standpoint of talking about reading rather than listening to podcasts. Get out there and read a book. And I'll probably finish the podcast like that too. But nevertheless, it's good advice. And today I'm going to have as a guest a person who is an author, particularly of middle school youth books, as a specialty. And he has recently completed a book as such. And I'm not going to tip too much about it. We're going to get into that into the podcast. And so I thought that you'd be interested in hearing what he has to say and how he kind of got into it. I know that I am. So please welcome my new friend, Greg Corin. Hi there, Greg.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me.
So, Greg, I've had a few other authors who have been on the podcast in the past. There are some things in which I personally find fascinating. And so that's why I really wanted to have you come and talk today, because this is a completely different kind of an offbeat thing than what most magicians would think of. Plus, this really is more directed to the public as opposed to the magician.
Absolutely.
Who is your publisher?
I'm actually self-published.
Okay.
I had an agent up until this book, and this was the book that kind of broke me away from the traditional model of publishing, and I thought I would try this on my own.
all of your books in the past have also been geared to middle-aged
they have.
Readers.
Right. And it's interesting. It was my agent of 13 years who convinced me to write a book with the main character who was a magician. Almost 5 years ago, I had written a book called Do-Over. And it was about a 13-year-old boy who has a premonition that his house is going to burn down in less than 24 hours.
Wow.
And it chronicles his efforts to prevent this from happening. And Danny, the main character, had a best friend named Ryan, and Ryan was a magician. And some misfortunes befall Ryan, which Danny also has a premonition about and is able to save Ryan from being hurt. And my agent loved the book, but Ryan was a secondary character.
Right.
And so when I was getting ready to write my next book, she said, Why don't you love magic? I'd perform for her family. And she said, why don't you ever write a book that has a main character who's a magician?
Right.
And it was a really interesting question. Maybe I was afraid to. I don't know I don't know what it was. But I resolved that with this book, which is called The Memory Trap, I was going to write a book that had as its main character a serious 12-year-old.
Yes.
But a serious magician. There's so many books out there with magic, but they stray into the supernatural. And I wanted a kid who was a serious magician, especially with cards.
Right.
So when we meet my main character, Henry Dunn, he's practicing double lifts with a deck of cards under the desk in his English class. And if I may, I'll just...
Yes, please do.
And the principal comes to his room and asks if he can talk to Danny, because that morning the principal's car had disappeared from a locked garage, a seemingly impossible situation. And so
it's like a murder in a locked room kind of
right,
thing.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a locked room mystery. And yeah. I've always loved locked room mysteries.
We all do.
So the principal takes Danny back to his office. And the first question he asks Danny is, how do you make an elephant disappear? And that's a total reference to Doug Henning. Because I saw Doug Henning on stage at the Ohio Theater when I was in high school. I don't even know if I was in high school. And my main character, Henry, asks the principal, he says, well, have you ever seen an elephant disappear? And the principal relates this event that he saw, and he doesn't mention...
From your eyes, basically.
Right. Yeah. And I'm just relating the story of when I saw Doug Henning make an elephant disappear.
Uh-huh.
Just... I mean, I'm sure you have a similar moment mm-hmm. when you saw a magician perform, and that changed the course of my life when I saw that. So really the book is a mystery within a mystery. Henry is being blamed for a series of increasingly mean-spirited pranks at his school. He's new to this school.
And you say he's what, 12 years old?
He's 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He used to live in a different part of the city. His parents moved him away because they felt the city was becoming less safe.
Okay.
And now he's in this new school. He doesn't know anyone. He's learning the mnemonica stack.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's constructed in his mind a memory palace. So this book, The Memory Trap, gives me a chance to talk a little bit about what a memory palace is, and then what the mnemonica stack is, and how you would go about memorizing the mnemonica stack based on a memory palace. So in Henry's mind, he builds this house, literal house, in his imagination out of cards. So he's got the Four of Clubs as the, you know, the doormat, and the Two of Hearts as the front door. But as his heart breaks at leaving behind his old house and his friends and the restaurant that his parents own, the house that he builds, the memory palace, slowly transforms into his old house. It becomes furnished with the furniture that used to fill his old house. And he starts spending a lot of time in this imaginary place. And it becomes for him a memory trap. And the same is true for the principal. The principal's car, which disappears from inside this garage, was a very important vehicle to him. It was the car that he and his father used to work on.
So it wasn't just a mode of transportation. It actually had some memory.
It was a very important car to him. And when it disappears, this man and this boy come together and agree to help each other out. He asks Henry to help him figure out how his car disappeared. And in exchange, the principal agrees to help find this shadowy character named the Joker, who leaves at the site of every one of these practical jokes a Joker from a blue-backed deck of bicycle cards, right?
Okay. Funny.
Which is Henry's favorite deck of cards. So it became a very important book to me because in 1983, I was the at-home parent for my two kids, Max and Mara. I even homeschooled them. Only Max for only 1 year when both Max and I realized he was too smart for me and we put him in a magnet
real school.
But Mara and I, we homeschooled for 4 more years, and it's hard for me to even talk about it without getting choked up, because that was, I know on my deathbed, that will stand as one of the shining moments of my life, spending time with my kids. I didn't come from the best family. And I really didn't have much of a relationship with my father or my mother. But one of the important aspects of homeschooling my kids was that I would read to them aloud every day. And we just went on hundreds of thrilling adventures. And I write these books with the idea that parents will read these books to their kids. But also, I really want to share my love of magic with kids, because that's how I learned magic, was
right
through reading. I didn't have the advantage of a magic group. I mean, there probably was in Delaware, Ohio, some magicians out there, but I didn't know who they were.
And you didn't seek them out, yeah.
I didn't know how to seek them out, and
okay,
my parents weren't much help. And
yeah,
so the library was where I learned magic.
Mm-hmm.
When my kids went off to college, and suddenly I wasn't the at-home parent anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I'd been forced into retirement, and I wasn't done being a dad.
Yeah.
You know, I just, my son had graduated from college. He went off to a career working for the NSA, essentially. And my daughter went off to college to start her path.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so lost. I really...
Really an empty nester.
My gosh. It was hard.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being in the grocery store one day. I didn't know how to fill my time.
Yeah.
And I was in the grocery store one day in the produce department. I picked up a cantaloupe. I just burst into tears. Mm. I mean, I'm standing there in the grocery store, and I'm just crying.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
I miss my kids
sure
so much.
I can understand that.
And it was then that I started writing books.
Yeah.
And I decided, like magic, writing saved my life. I mean, it helped me to deal with some really difficult issues. And I think in 1983...
It's cathartic.
I'm sorry?
It's cathartic. I think writing is cathartic.
It really is. And in 1983, I think I was becoming as trapped in memory as both Henry and Principal Pal in my book are becoming. They're lost in memory. They're holding on to memories that are not serving them well anymore.
Hmm.
And so I wrote Do-Over, which was my effort to rewind time, to try to hold on to when my kids were younger and I was younger, and the future just seemed so far away, and the present was just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a perfect time in my life. And then when the kids took off, I started writing The Memory Trap, because I wanted to figure out how to get unstuck from memory. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I was going to say that it was as much for you as it is for the readers.
It really is.
Yeah. Boy, so many things to unpack here.
sorry about that.
That's okay. Now, the first thing that comes to mind is my friend John Gaspard, who has been writing the Eli Marks Magic Detective novels series.
Oh, I have some friends who have been recommending those to me.
Oh, yeah.
Me.
Highly recommend them.
Oh, my gosh.
He was saying that his publisher had said, too, you know, why can't he just wave a wand, you know, be like Harry Potter? And he said, I do not want him to be having supernatural powers, exactly like you were saying as well. In other words, I want him to use natural means that a magician would use his intellect and skills to get out of a situation or to
precisely
use some subterfuge or some misdirection or something to solve whatever, or you know, his knowledge of the dark arts, you know, I guess, you know, any magical skills, basically. Well, it sounds like that yours is the same thing, that you have kept true to it, and you don't have a publisher who's saying, hey, because obviously magic sells. I mean, you look at, you know, J.K. Rowling and others who have, you know, followed in that ilk. So I would think that if you, you know, keep true to that, you having a new genre that you're joining, basically, that for readers that will also empower the young readers to use their skills, knowing that, okay, well, I'm not going to be on a flying carpet because that's unreal. I mean, a fantasy kind of a thing, but you are encouraging them, young readers, to learn to read and to rely on themselves and their own skills because they can't rely on some fantasy skill that they will never have.
Precisely. Yes, absolutely. And I don't know if, I don't know your experience in high school, but I really think magic got me through high school. Hmm. I wasn't, and maybe this is true of a lot of your listeners, I wasn't the smartest. I wasn't the most athletic. I wasn't the best looking, but magic set me apart.
Well, see, I was all of those, so I
you
never,
were, so yeah, you so, didn't need magic.
I didn't make it.
Well, I wasn't. So thank goodness for magic, because really distinguished me from everyone else. And so I got invited to parties I never would have gotten invited
That's
to.
That's right. Very good point. Yeah.
Because of magic. And I wanted to show, with Henry Dunn in my book, I wanted to show a kid who is different than everybody else and thinks differently than everybody else.
And is accepted for that, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. At the end, by the end. Yes, absolutely.
So he's chastised the first part, I guess, mercilessly. And
bullied. And because magic is so, in at this school, magic and practical jokes are synonymous for each other. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a magician, you're a prankster.
Okay.
And so he's, you know, automatically accused without any evidence. But yeah, I wanted to show, I think magicians, we are different creatures in a way. Mm-hmm. We see the world in a different way. So I'm hoping that kids who come to this book, or parents who buy this book to read to their kids, which is my dream, the kids will come away feeling better about what makes them unique, but perhaps sets them apart from everyone else, even if it's not magic. But I hope that it awakens that interest in them, that in the way that books did that for me. I don't know how many kids, you know, I like to think kids are reading more, but it disturbs me so much to see kids on looking at screens all the time. And
more often.
Yeah. And more often I see parents using screens to parent their kids. Even in restaurants, I love taking my kids to restaurants. And now too often I see parents come into a restaurant and they'll make a half attempt to engage their kids in conversation or some activity. And then eventually here comes the phone and the kids on the phone and the parents just sitting there in a half doze. And I just want to get away from it. I want to empower parents to take the time to read to their kids, not necessarily in a restaurant, but you know what I mean?
I do remember the day whenever that people would actually bring books and they would read in a restaurant. I remember seeing kids.
I still do that.
Having that. Going to the meat of the thing that you were writing about Mnemonica Stack, about learning that. Are you talking about that particularly? I mean, and naming it the Mnemonica, or are you just talking about a stack? Or, you know, so how much detail are you giving the public?
I only give, I mention it by name, a Mnemonica. I don't go
into. You talk about one-timers and everything then?
I do.
Okay.
I don't give any detail into what the stack is. Only that whenever Henry hears a number, he quickly converts that into what the card is. And the Mnemonica actually is important at the end of the book. It's actually what saves the kids. His knowledge of Mnemonica and his use of the memory palace is what allows him to save him and his other two friends. I didn't think about it, but that really is the turning point. his knowledge of the Monica is what really saves him.
Hmm.
In the same way that magic saved me when I was in high school, I guess that's.
Do you see this as being a series?
You know, I never thought about writing a series, and yeah. I know for young people that's what the recommendation is. Mm-hmm. At least write 3 books in a series. Mm-hmm. But up till now, I've written several books, and they've all been different. But I love Henry, and I could easily see myself. And I think, Scott, what I mentioned was what my agent had a problem with this book was she said in no uncertain terms that young people cannot have friendships with adults. Mm-hmm. And as a homeschooler, I know that's not true. Homeschooling is the world of children and adults interacting with each other.
True.
But I think that's true with magic too. I think magicians, young magicians, if they're lucky, they get to mentor with an adult and they become friends. And I didn't agree with my agent. I mm-hmm. said, no, I disagree. I think young people and adults can have friendships.
Sure.
They can work together. They can grow together. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that's what Big Brothers and Big Sisters is all about, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, and that actually led to me leaving her agency because I felt so strongly about yeah. this book. I didn't want to compromise it for that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. No, I understand that. How much inside baseball are you talking about? I mean, are there terms that you're using or things that you're having to explain, saying this is what the magician
would say? I do explain
what
a double lift is because that's what Henry is really trying to nail when we meet him.
Mm-hmm.
And the mnemonica stack is less explicit because I really would love kids to come to it on their own way.
Mm-hmm.
But the bar bet, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you probably know it. You put a glass down on a table, put a hat over the top, and you say, I'm going to drink that drink without lifting the hat.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yeah, the kids will be able to do that at a bar immediately after reading the book. So.
Well, or in the cafeteria, with some grape juice or something.
That's what I meant, right?
Of course. Not encouraging underage drinking here.
No, we're not.
Well, it sounds interesting. And where is it available? Where can people pick that up?
It's right now just available on electronic. So it's as Kindle and Nook. It's available to all e-readers.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an iPad, Amazon provides a free download, which will put the Kindle app on your your iPad or phone,
mm-hmm.
although I can't imagine reading on a phone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's available in that way. And then I'll be, in another month, I'll be rolling out the paperback version.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been getting great reviews. And what astonishes me is that it's most of the reviews are from parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a dream come true
mm-hmm.
because the best times in my life were sitting with my kids and reading to them.
Right.
And that's what I think's going on maybe a little bit with this book is that parents are finding it interesting enough to hold their interest and interesting enough to their kids that they're going on this pretty exciting adventure, I think, together.
Right. Yeah, I like that. When you come up with a book idea, do you write it down or does it come to you slowly or do you generally have the concept of a beginning, middle, and end, then you flesh the rest of it in or do you have the end in mind or how does that come about?
Oh, that's a really good question. I always know how it ends. Not specifically, but I know when I was finishing my previous book, Do Over, I had already started thinking about the memory trap. And I had, there's this road I travel on to and from the coffee shop where I write.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty lonely stretch of road. And I remember being out on it one night at night, and it was rainy. And it looked desolate. And I thought, this is where my next book is going to end, on this lonely stretch of road. But character is super important to mm-hmm. me, more than anything. And I spend a lot of time thinking about characters. And I create sheets. I'll write out character backgrounds and profiles of them. So I have a clear image of them in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But no, writing is a pretty grand adventure for me. I have a general sense of the end. I know a couple of things I want to happen in the middle, but I kind of want to experience it as I write it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to close by finding out what is it that is important to you. Not necessarily a word like abracadabra, but, you know, what is your philosophy of life? I mean, you've discussed a lot of things. We talk about a lot of things that have influenced you and directions that you're going, but what do you live for every day? What's important?
Well, as corny as it sounds, it's really my family. Every book I've ever written, I've dedicated to my family. I keep thinking I've dedicated enough books to them. I could probably move beyond them to dedicate it to someone else, but I keep coming back to them. I love my kids. I have two. One lives in Massachusetts. The other is in Maryland, but somewhat far from me. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm not a dad anymore,
I'm always a dad.
Yeah. But I'm not a dad in the way I've been a dad. Uh-huh. That is absolutely it. And my marriage. I mean, that's the two things.
Yeah, family is important.
Absolutely. Yep. There's nothing more important than that for me.
Got to keep your focus on that's what's important.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Great. Greg, thanks very much. That's great.
Scott, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And good luck with the book. And
thank you.
What's the website? Is there a website they can go to?
Amazon, absolutely.
Okay, but I mean, is there a website where people can go find more detail about
GregCorin.com.
Okay.
And there's actually a link on there. I talk about how Doug Henning was my influence for the disappearing car in my book, and I provide a link to a video that shows that elephant disappearing. It's absolutely worth watching again.
Okay, great. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Greg Corin, and this is Scotty Out.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and joining me now all the way from Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota, is Mr. John Gaspard. Hey there, John.
Hello, Scott.
It's sounds like you're asleep. Hello, Scott. You sound so serious all of a sudden, you know.
I'm sorry. I was just trying to be warm, but it came across as morbid, I guess.
Yes, well, that's right. Well, you know, I know that writing is a serious business, and I should have started this out by saying, let me introduce author of now the sixth in a series of mystery novels featuring Eli Marks as the magician who ends up being a detective, Mr. John Gaspard. Hey, how about that?
Hi, Scott. How are you?
See, you answered the same way. Hi, Scott.
I guess we're stuck with it. We're stuck with it.
Oh. So, hey, listen, since I mentioned Minneapolis, before we get started talking about the book, I know that you're involved with Suzanne in co-producing Sunday Night Magic. And, you know, there are more and more venues that are popping up around the United States. You know, of course, the Chicago Magic Lounge, there's House of Cards in Nashville, Smoke and Mirrors out in Philadelphia, and it goes on and on. There are several that are starting to pop up around the country, and some are weekly, some are nightly, and yours is monthly, as I understand. Is that correct?
That's right. We are 9 months out of the year. We take off the summer and December. Mm-hmm. But other than that, and it's always a different Sunday during the month because the theater that lets us use their space, it depends on what their schedule is, but there's always one free Sunday that they have. And so we go in and take over for the evening.
So it's not necessarily the third Sunday or something like that. It may vary.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is a little bit difficult that way to get people, for people to plan it. So we try to keep them posted as to all the dates on Facebook so they know what's what.
Well, one of the nice things also is that the performers that you have come in to perform, they also are allowed to do a lecture earlier in the day for your magic group.
Well, you know, when Suzanne first approached me and said, because I was a student of Suzanne's. She's the one who taught me how to do the ambitious card, which is what the first book was about. And then we became friends. And she approached me and said she really wanted to bring – she's meeting all these wonderful magicians when she go out to the Magic Castle, which she does once or twice a year and performs. Mm-hmm. She said, I'd love to have them come back and do lectures because it's so hard in Minneapolis. You don't get a chance to meet that many, you know, other magicians besides the people you know. And I said, well, if we're going to do that, if we're going to go to that trouble, we should also have a public side of it. So it sort of has settled into they come in on a Saturday. We take them out for a nice dinner Saturday night. Sunday afternoon, they do a lecture for anywhere between 50 and 30 local magicians. Then we take them to dinner and then over to the theater, and we'll have a couple local magicians, and then they are our headliner, and they do 30 to 45 minutes.
Now, how large is the theater?
The theater, it holds about 280, but it's a theater in the round. Mm-hmm. So we just use half of it. So it's sort of a becomes a proscenium stage at that point where there's no sightline issues. And our best size audience is about 105. We can hold 150, but it gets a little bit dicey on the sides at that point. But I think when we had Derek Hughes, who's a local guy here, I think he was close to 125.
And some of the other people you've had as guests?
Oh, my goodness. The people that Suzanne knows are just amazing. We had Eugene Berger did, I believe, what was his last public performance with us. We had Max Maven. We had Hannibal. We've had Pop Hayden. Jay Johnson, the ventriloquist, who's sort of a friend of mine, came and did it once. Derek Hughes has done it. Nick DeFat, who is from here, has come and done it. It's just amazing the people that have come through, and it just gets better and better. We've got I've been going back and forth with John Carney. He's coming in September. We got David Regal in October, and then Handsome Jack is going to come in November and do kind of a dual thing with Derek Hughes.
So if somebody is interested in you considering them for coming up and doing a lecture and performing, how will they get in contact with you on that? Or Suzanne?
If they don't have access to Suzanne personally, they can just go to Sunday Night Magic on Facebook and just send a message, and then she gets it that way.
Okay, good idea. So that's really, rather than a website, you use Facebook for promoting this?
We do. Okay. It's kind of an ad hoc show, and we know what we're doing through November, and then we have no idea what happens after that.
Right. I understand. Well, speaking of promoting things, that I wanted to talk a little bit about your upcoming book. Now, I'm very excited about this because it's the sixth in the series. And golly, you know, when we first talked about the Ambitious Card some years ago, you had envisioned, even at that point, some this continuing to be a series, because the central character of Eli Marks, who is a magician and kind of by default becomes a detective in helping to solve crimes, you know, just has a lot of different facets with between him and his friends and relatives, that really fleshing this out. So you don't have to necessarily have read all the books to understand that, but you kind of bring people up to date with each book, which can be a standalone.
Yeah, they all do standalone. They do go, sort of grow in order, except for this newest one, which is called The Zombie Ball. And this one actually is a flashback book. It takes place before the events of the very first book, and you learn how certain things came to be that we've kind of taken for granted throughout the series, and you get to experience what Eli's life was like immediately after his divorce, which has been sort of touched on but never really dealt with. And it also explains a couple other things, and it's really fun because there's certain things that Eli's done that I've wanted to kind of delve into as to why he does what he does. And you find all that out in The Zombie Ball.
And all of the titles of the books are actually trick titles, just like The Zombie Ball, which is really not about a zombie ball. You want to explain that?
Sure. Eli's hired to perform at an event called The Zombie Ball, which is a zombie pub crawl. I don't know if you have those down in Houston. That's where people dress up like zombies and they go from bar to bar.
Yeah, we do have pub crawls, but they don't dress up like zombies.
Yeah, it's more kind of a Halloween thing here. Huh. And in the book, that has grown from a pub crawl to a large gala event that raises money for a charity. And because it's called The Zombie Ball, Eli's agent books him for it because she knows he has a trick called The Zombie Ball. She has no idea what that trick is, but she thinks there's a tie-in when, in fact, there is no tie-in. It just happens to be called The Zombie Ball. So he is booked for it, because another magician has backed out at the last minute for a more high-paying gig, and all of a sudden he's thrust into this gala event where two of the top sponsors are murdered backstage while the show is going on. And he also does have to perform the zombie ball, which he hasn't performed in a while. He does own one. He just doesn't do it all that often.
By request. Yeah, I think that many of us as magicians and performers have perhaps done something in our shows some point in our life, and then we get booked by that someone who saw us way back when. So I remember you did such and such. Can you do that again? And it's like, I got to pull that out of my repertoire. It's been a while back since I've last done that. But the answer is always yes, you know.
Yeah, I think he says in the book that in the right hands, the zombie ball is a thing of beauty. And in his hands, it kills 5 to 7 minutes. So, it's a fun premise. Because I always try to put him in a situation where as a performer, he's not quite ready to go. Everything isn't quite up to speed. The beauty of Eli as a character is he is a pretty good magician. He's not a great magician. His Uncle Harry is a great magician, and so he has that as a model, but he's never quite risen to that. He's an okay detective, but he's not a great detective. In fact, someone pointed out to me recently that in about half the books, Eli not only doesn't solve the crime, but is dead wrong about who the killer is and is almost killed because of it. Now, he does use his wits to get himself out of that situation, but he's not like Sherlock Holmes. He doesn't always figure it out. He's just very much like an average person like myself, for example, who, if you put me in one of those escape rooms, I would never be able to figure it out. And that's sort of the way Eli is. His ex-wife says he has a weird way of looking at things, and sometimes that helps him figure out how something's done, but sometimes he figures it out just a few seconds too late.
That's what I like about Eli March is he is kind of an everyman kind of a person in which that he is, as you say, not a great magician, not a great detective. He's good at both, but he was kind of thrust into the detective business, so to speak, each time. You know, it's something in which he just happens to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, or maybe at the right place at the wrong time in order to help solve this.
Right, but he's also dealing with, you know, issues of, that other magicians run into, which is, you know, I don't practice enough. There's another magician in town who gets all the gigs, so I'm jealous. So he's very, very human in that way. He's not a superhuman character. So one of the most gratifying things about working on the books has been that, you know, I put a lot of effort into making the magic right. And, you know, I'm not a magician, but I knew the magicians would hate reading it and having the magic be wrong. And so I was working on the book The Linking Rings, which is a fourth book in the series. And there's a quote I wanted to use at the beginning. So I always open them with a quote from a magician. And the quote was, "Sometimes magic is just someone spending more time on something than anyone else might reasonably expect." And it was a quote from Teller. And it's perfect for that book because that's the whole book is about cold revenge and waiting a long, long time to do something. So I know someone who knows him. So I emailed her and she emailed him and said, "This guy wants to use this quote. Can you use a quote?" And Teller was very nice and emailed back. He said, "By all means, go ahead and use it." So I finished the book. It comes out and I thought, well, I always send whoever gives me the quotes a copy of the book. So I sent care of the Rio Hotel in Las Vegas to Teller. Here's a copy of The Linking Rings. And a couple weeks later, I got a nice little note back, handwritten note saying, you know, "Thanks so much for sending it." And I thought, well, that was very, very nice of him. And then about a month or two after, they got an email. And it just, the subject line says, "From Teller." And in it, he says, and I'll just pull it up here, "John, I was in the exact right mood for a detective novel and enjoyed The Linking Rings." So that little quote I put right on the front of the book because it was so, so nice. And then he wrote, "I especially like the accurate behind the scenes aspect of it. Usually magic detective stories don't really have a clue about the mentality and preoccupations of magicians. Yours is true to life." And then he went on to say, and I'm going to not say the names of the characters here, "And I was sure the killer was blank, so you surprised me. I kept waiting for the whole blank thing to be a red herring, and then blank turns out to have been the killer." And I thought, that's amazing. I told a friend of mine that, and he said, "Oh, you fooled Teller. You didn't fool Penn and Teller, but you fooled Teller, and that's the more important one to fool." And I thought, well, I don't know if that really counts as a fool us moment, but it was really, really sweet of him to not only let me use the quote, but then send me a nice little note and then send this lovely email telling me that he enjoyed the book. And that's, you know, that's for me exactly what I was looking for was I want real life magicians to read this if they enjoy mysteries and to not throw it across the room because the magic is wrong. I want them to enjoy it because the magic is right and the attitude is right and the problems are correct. So it's just very nice for it to turn out that way.
Yeah, that's great to know. It sounds like that you won an FT award instead of an FU award. You fooled Teller, not both of them.
Yes. And it's fine because I have a couple friends who actually have fooled Penn and Teller on the show, and I've only fooled one of them, but that's fine. No, it was just fantastic to get that.
Great story. Another thing, too, that I think is interesting between him and his Uncle Harry is that Eli is kind of what I call a 30-miler. He's kind of doesn't do anything much out of his area, whereas Harry is well-known, I mean, like over at the Magic Circle and everywhere, and he's kind of toured the world, and now he's retired there in Minneapolis.
Yeah, there's a real vast difference between their skill sets in that Uncle Harry has really done everything, every type of magic, every type of performing. And so we use that as a resource for Eli, but he is always – Well, imagine yourself if you were brought up by an uncle who was essentially a combination of Jay Marshall and Eugene Berger.
Wow.
So you have that philosophy side that Eugene brought to it and that, you know, depth of experience that Jay Marshall had. And that's what he's up against. That's the best image he has. And he has trouble living up to that.
Sure. Yeah, as most any of us would, I think. It's true.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And this is going to be available as a Kindle and an ebook when?
It comes out August 27th. It'll be out in paperback, ebook. We just sent in the audiobook, and that'll be out, if not by the 27th, not long thereafter.
And all that's available on Amazon?
Yes, all the books are available on Amazon, and they're all available in all those formats, plus we're also still working on hardcovers. But the most popular format seems to be Kindle.
Speaking of covers, I was going to get to that. Did you get a new publisher or something? Because that all of the covers have now been revised. I love the new covers. They're beautiful.
You. I'm semi-retired from my business, but I have more time than I used to. And so I negotiated with the publisher to get back the rights to the first four books. And I've been publishing. I've published the fifth one myself because they were kind of done with it and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot more going on. They didn't quite know what to do with it. And I don't blame them because I don't really quite know what to do with it either. But that meant getting new covers. And, so I started working with an artist that I found in England who I thought just did a really beautiful job of giving each one its own. You know, they all look like they're part of the series, but each has its own identity.
That's a good way of putting it. Whereas the other ones still had the same color and font and everything. It looked pretty much the same just at a glance, whereas these are all different in a different color, but they do still have that look, if you will.
Yeah, now I mean maybe it's just because they're my books, but I think that kind of each one looks like a little piece of art.
Yes.
They just have a really lovely look to them.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. Well, I'm guessing also another thing is that when you say that your publisher didn't quite know what to do with it, I remember one of our earlier discussions that you had said that they were wanting you to take the magician off into this ethereal thing in which they actually had magical powers, and you said, no, I want to be true to the fact that he just uses wits and his sleight of hand.
Yeah, that was actually the publisher before that one.
Oh, okay.
Who said, well, why isn't he like Harry Potter? And I thought, well, okay, I guess you didn't read the book because he's nothing like Harry Potter at all. the problem that the most recent publisher had, and it's not her fault, she's a wonderful publisher, is that most of this style of book, which is called a cozy mystery, has a female lead and is written by a female author. Most of them, like 99% of them. And that's what she sold. That's what she knew how to market. And this doesn't really quite fit in that niche.
Gotcha.
So now that I'm marketing it myself, I've found kind of a better niche for it. And it's only been a little over a month, but they're selling quite nicely because I'm targeting them at I think a better audience.
And are you still going to be having the signings, book signings and things like that that you had before at some of the bookstores?
I'm still doing that, and I'm oddly enough a full-fledged member of a group called Sisters in Crime, which is a national organization of mystery writers, and it's about 70% women. There are about 30% of us are men,
mm-hmm.
And we do a lot of the local Twin Cities chapter does a lot of kind of outreach where we go to libraries and festivals and things. They want mystery writers to come and talk and to explain how we come up with our plots.
I think what is also interesting as we start to wrap up here is that you also have some shorter novels, like the one about the Greyhound of the Baskervilles, or what was that? It was
Greyhound of the Baskervilles. I'll talk about that very quickly because it's been sort of funny. I have had over the years several rescue greyhounds as pets, and they're lovely. They're lovely animals. They have their own goofy little worlds. And I woke up one morning and just the title, The Greyhound of the Baskervilles, came into my head, and I thought, that's funny. That's kind of interesting. And I looked online and the book, The Hound of the Baskervilles, was in public domain. And I thought, well, let's just see if I can turn this into the same story, but narrated by a dog instead of by Dr. Watson. And I just started every day working a little bit on it. And as it turned out, it was quite simple to change the perspective. Dr. Watson is still in it, but everything is told from the point of view of Sherlock's greyhound, Septimus. And it's the exact same story in most of the dialogue. It's a little shorter all around. And the only real difference is at the end, Septimus steps in and saves everybody from the attack of the terrible beast, the Hound of the Baskervilles.
And where was that released? Was that actually available on Amazon?
That is on Amazon. And Yes, it's on Amazon. It'll be out later this year as an audiobook. The funny thing is that the Amazon people, anytime I make any change to, if you're marketing books, sometimes you go in and you have to change keywords for search optimization, that sort of thing. And then it gets resaved, and I'll start getting emails back from Amazon saying, your book, The Greyhound of the Baskervilles, is a public domain book. You're not allowed to change anything on it. And I have to go back to them and say, no, The Hound of the Baskervilles is public domain. The Greyhound of the Baskervilles is a new work because it uses a lot of Conan Doyle stuff, and he is credited as the main author on it, but it's not the same one. And they just cannot get it in their heads that The Greyhound of Baskervilles is different than The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Right. But that was one of your short stories. And another one that you've just completed is actually an audiobook, which you're going to be giving us as an exclusive here after our chat. So can you tell us just a little bit about that as we kind of do an opening into
sure
that?
Sure thing. We just wrapped up recording the audiobook for the Zombie Ball. And when we were finishing, my narrator, Jim Cunningham, said, I've got about an hour. Is there anything else you need recorded? And I said, you know, I've never recorded this story. It was called The Last Customer, and it was written for an anthology called Bloodwork. And this quick story behind that was there's a bookstore in town called Once Upon a Crime, and the owner of it, Gary, died, I think like 4 years ago, died of leukemia. And so a bunch of authors got together, and we put together an anthology book where the funds in profits from it go to the foundation for fighting leukemia. And the only thing you had to do as a short story writer to be in that book was it had to be a mystery, it had to take place in a bookstore or be about books, and it had to involve a tuba. So I wrote this little thing called The Last Customer, which is about Eli wrapping up his day in the store with one last customer, and a kid comes in.
In his brick-and-mortar magic shop.
Yep, brick-and-mortar. And kid comes in with a request about how to make a tuba disappear. So it's a kind of an O. Henry-esque little thing. It does have some magic stuff in it that I've wanted to get in other books and never been able to fit in there. It's just a short little goofy little Eli Marks semi-mystery that's sort of fun. And I got to have Jim Cunningham read it. And I think I've said this to you before. The books are so much better having him read them. I enjoy, as the guy who wrote them, I enjoy listening to them more than I enjoy reading them because he does such a nice job.
He has a wonderful voice. And you were telling me he was the voice of the hockey team up there?
He does announcing for the hockey team for the Wild. He also does announcing for the Minnesota Twins. He's done that for, I think, 20-some years. And he also is the feast master at the Renaissance Festival for several weekends during the summer. He gets run. He's also the third partner in Sunday Night Magic. And he's our MC and host.
Oh, he helps then also. Very good. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a great opening for the clip, or not clip, but the whole book that we're going to be hearing here next. So,
short story, not a book.
No, sorry.
Short story.
Short story.
I don't want them to expect a whole book. It really is just 20 minutes of goofiness.
A short story. And I want to wish you good luck then with the new book, The Zombie Ball, which again, people are going to be able to pick up. This is going to be released on August the 22nd. So it's going to be then the following week in which that this will be available. I noticed that the ebook is on Amazon. So can you order that right now on Amazon, or is that just for pre-orders?
You can pre-order, and you can find all the books if you don't want to go to Amazon right away. Just go to EliMarksMysteries.com. EliMarksMysteries.com, and it has all the books and information on all of them, and then it just might be simpler than digging through Amazon.
I think that's probably a better idea. Plus, it also, you can see the beautiful covers that they're all on all the new books there as well. Well, John, thanks very much for being my guest, and thanks for continuing with this series. I am just excited about what you've done, and glad to kind of let the rest of the magic community know about this, because it's quite different. It's not a magic book. It's a magic detective series. It's just one, and Eli's great, you know, and all the characters. You've done a great job, and so thank you for what you've been contributing to us.
Thank you, Scott.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, stay tuned and let's listen to The Last Customer by John Gaspard, read by Jim Cunningham.
The Last Customer, an Eli Marks short mystery, written by John Gaspard, read by Jim Cunningham. I thought he was going to be my last customer, which was a bit ironic because after a long day in the shop, he was also my first customer. Such is the sad life of a brick-and-mortar magic shop in this day of online browsing and shopping. At the moment, though, I was in a bit of a fog trying to decide if the customer's shaggy hair would best be described as dishwater blonde or sandy brown. In the midst of what I'm guessing you would call a transaction, the bell over the shop's entrance tinkled. The last customer and I looked at the door as it swung open, and for a moment I thought it might have just been the wind, as no one was immediately visible in the doorway. Then I glanced down and saw a kid. He might have been 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. I really have no concept of the standard height-to-age ratio with kids these days, but he looked young. "We're closed," I said, working hard to take any unintended tone out of my voice. "The sign in the window says open," the kid said, glancing around the shop, a little wide-eyed at all the magic tricks, posters, and miscellanea that gave Chicago magic its old-world charm. At least, that's what I chose to think. He also might have been looking at all the clutter and dust. "I haven't gotten around to flipping the sign," I said, glancing at the customer to see if this interruption was having any sort of impact on his mood. He seemed as stunned at the kid's moxie as I was. "Well, then, you're open," the kid said as he stepped further into the shop. "This won't take long anyway. I need your help, and I need it pronto." The door swung shut behind him, and I exchanged a look with the customer. He nodded a quick assent. "Okay," I said. "What's the problem?" The kid took a deep breath. "I need to make a tuba disappear," he said. "Like now." I like to think I've heard my share of odd requests in the 20-plus years I've either helped at the magic shop or run it on my own, but this was a new one. Deep down, I knew this moment was not an ideal one for tackling new questions, but I took the kid at his word that this would be a speedy exchange. "Just how do you mean disappear?" I asked. "Like this," he said, pulling out his iPhone. He had a video from YouTube preloaded, and he held it up for me to see. The customer leaned in as well. I recognized the video immediately. It was David Copperfield, the magician, not the Dickens character, pulling off one of his most talked-about illusions, making the Statue of Liberty disappear. The pacing of the performance was a whole lot slower than I remembered, but for the television audience and the small audience watching it live on site, it was still an impressive feat. "That's a pretty big effect," I said. "The tuba's a pretty big instrument," the kid countered. "Fair point," I agreed. "But before we get into the how, maybe it would be best to go over the why?" The kid sighed as if he was being forced to repeat previously discussed information to a much older, much dimmer person. He wasn't far off. "Tomorrow is a talent show at school. Everybody is required to perform in some way. My mom says I have to play the tuba because of all the money she's been shelling out for lessons."
"Then why don't you just play the tuba?"
"Are you kidding?" he nearly yelped. "A tuba? I'll be laughed off the stage."
"He sort of has a point."
This was from the customer, who up until now had been watching this exchange quietly, and I hoped, patiently. "So instead," the kid continued excitedly, "I want to come out with the tuba and then make it disappear right before their eyes, as if by magic," he added, to ensure I was following his not-too-Byzantine thought process.
"Okay, that's a fair premise. How much experience do you have doing magic?"
The kid shrugged. "None, I guess. But it's only one trick," he said confidently. "I figured I could just buy something here to make it happen. Nothing too complicated or expensive," he added, "and nothing too big. I'm already hauling around a tuba."
"Simple to do, not too expensive, and easy to carry around," I summarized quietly.
This request was a common one, and sadly, not from just neophyte magicians. I was happy, not for the first time today, that my Uncle Harry was not manning the shop. It was just this sort of request that would have sent him into an apoplectic fit.
"Well," I said as I processed the request, "a vanish like that requires a lot of control on the part of the magician. You need to manage the audience sight lines, the lighting, the backdrop, in some cases, the construction of the stage itself. Are you likely to have control of any of those factors? I assume these requirements would sound the death knell for his idea, but amazingly, he actually thought it over for several long moments. Finally, he shook his head. No. All we get to do is walk out there and perform. Well, making the tuba disappear seems to be off the table then, I said. Wait, the kid began, but I held up a hand. But that doesn't mean we still can't do something magical, I interjected quickly. It's just a matter of figuring out what that something might be. Having faced variations on this question my entire working life, I did what I always did. I crossed the store to a large floor-to-ceiling bookcase that lined one wall of the shop. The answer we need is somewhere in here, I said, glancing over my shoulder. The kid had followed me while the customer stayed at the cash register, his hands still shoved deep into the pockets of his worn and faded army jacket. From this new vantage point, I decided that his hair color was definitely sandy brown. He stared at me blankly, so I quickly turned back to the task at hand. The kid stood next to me while I scanned the spines of the books. He looked up at a sign positioned at the top of the bookcase. What does 793.8 mean? He asked. I glanced up at the placard. It had been there for so many years I had stopped seeing it, which was odd given that I had been the one to print it and post it. Well, my Uncle Harry has had this habit for years of lending books from the store to magicians rather than selling them outright. In his view, if they don't like the book, they will bring the book back. If they do like the book, they will come back and pay for it. The kid looked up at me doubtfully. How's that working out for him? About how you'd expect, I said, which is to say, not well. And since I felt he was turning this into a lending library, I put up that sign. 793.8 is the Dewey Decimal listing for magic books in libraries. He was looking up at me blankly again, so I continued. A library is a building where you can borrow books. He cut me off. I know what a library is, he snapped. I'm just surprised that any of them are still using the outmoded Dewey system instead of the far better Library of Congress classification method. Now it was my turn to stare blankly at him. You hear the word precocious much? I finally said. Now and again. I'm not surprised, I said, returning my attention to the rows of book options in front of me. I think what we need is something that makes the tuba the cause rather than the effect, so that there's a reason for the tuba. Otherwise, it just seems like an unnecessary prop. My voice trailed off as I scanned the titles. Most were on magic theory, while others focused so minutely on specific styles of magic, cards, coins, big box illusions, that they would be essentially useless in this instance. And then I saw what I was looking for and gave a small cry of inspiration. This is what we need, I said, as I pulled the book off the shelf and read the title out loud. Harry's Magic Emporium. I opened the book and began to page through it quickly. What's it called? The voice surprised me. I turned to see the customer was peering at us from across the room. He had moved away from his position, leaning on the counter, and it started to move across the shop. It's Harry's Magic Emporium, I repeated, splitting my attention between the book and the customer, who was now moving toward us. My Uncle Harry wrote it, I added. I remember that book, the customer said, sounding surprised at the memory. I had it when I was a kid. In addition to the tricks, there were a lot of dumb jokes in it, right? Yes. Tons of them. No one loves a bad joke more than my uncle, but thankfully, no one loves a great trick more than he does either. Now, I seem to remember that he organized the book around the 13 different types of magic, the list he used to argue with Harry Blackstone Jr. about all the time. I said as I continued flipping through the book. There've got to be more than 13 magic tricks, the kid said. His tone suggested that he may have wandered into the wrong shop today. On one level, he was right, but his statement was off base. There are hundreds more, I said, but they can all be classified into one of 13 categories. You know, production, vanish, restoration, animation, penetration, transposition. Just like any time I tried to name all the seven dwarfs, I started strong and then petered out about halfway through the list. You get the idea, I finally said, still paging through the book in hopes that inspiration would leap from one of the pages. The room was quiet for a few moments, the only sound being paper on paper as I scanned rapidly through the book. Do you serve crabs here? The question came from the customer, and I froze in mid-page turn. I looked over my shoulder at him. Excuse me? The patron says, do you serve crabs here? And the maitre d' says, we serve everyone, sir. Let me get you a seat. The customer laughed at the joke, shaking his head at the memory. I thought it was funny long before I understood what it meant. I nodded in agreement. I had that same reaction to a lot of Harry's jokes. They were like little joke time bombs set to go off at a later unknown date. Like, why is 6 afraid of 7? I looked from the customer to the kid. The kid had no response, but the customer thought for a moment and then laughed. Because 7, 8, 9, he said, smiling for the first time since he'd entered the store. This is great, the kid said without inflection. Big laughs. But can we focus on my disappearing tuba? Right, I agreed, turning my attention back to the book. I think our best bet would be to use the tuba as a production tool of some kind, sort of like a magician's top hat. Do you have a stand for the tuba? I asked, without looking up from paging through the book. Of course I do. The thing's as big as I am, the kid snapped. I got the sense that, to his young mind, I was the stupidest person he had ever met. That will help, I said, flipping quickly to the chapter on production. Do you only have one copy of the book? This was asked by the customer, who had moved again and was now standing silently behind me. I successfully squelched a yelp. Nope. Harry has a ton of them, I said, reaching up and pulling another copy off the shelf. I handed it to the customer, who took his hands out of his pocket for the first time, as he grasped the book and began to page through it. What if we did this? I began, seeing a chapter on silk productions. What if you came out and started to play, but only got some odd sounds out of the tuba, like, you know, something was stuck in the horn? The bell, the kid said. What? It's called the bell. The whole thing is the horn. The part you can reach into is called the bell. The bell, whatever. What if that were the premise? You keep trying to play something with the tuba, and you get horrible sounds out of it, and you keep pulling different odd things out of the horn. The bell. The kid smiled and nodded. Sure, that would be fun. But there's limited space in the bell. I mean, not as much as you might think. Not a problem. We have ways around that, I said, handing the book to the kid. Go to the index and look up Servant, I said, as I turned away and began to scan the products on the shelves. What's a Servant? The kid asked, as he dutifully turned to the back of the book. It's a secret way to make things appear and disappear, I said. Magicians use them all the time. Cool, the kid said, focusing on his search. Indeed, I said absently. I was looking for items that were designed to pack small and transform to full size with very little effort. I saw a black and white cane that would do the trick, pulled it off the shelf, and then reached for a compact bouquet of roses. Here's one you'll like, the customer said suddenly. I spun around, but he had his face buried in the book. What musical instrument is found in the bathroom? He must have seen that I was busy looking for props, so he turned to the kid and repeated the question, barely able to contain his amusement. What musical instrument is found in the bathroom? The kid shrugged. I don't know. The customer laughed as he gave the answer, sort of killing the joke while completing it. A tube of toothpaste. Get it? A tube of toothpaste. You should use that one. Sure thing, the kid said flatly, imitating the response of every comedian I've ever met when a layperson offers a joke for their act. I'll get right on it. I cut into the conversation, laying out items on a nearby counter. I don't know the sequence yet, I said, as I arranged the ragtag selection of props. But these are all things you can hide in the horn, sorry, in the bell, or in a servant we put behind it. It took a few minutes, but between the kid and me, we structured a short but funny act that involved him pulling an impossible number of items out of the tuba, but still getting poor results every time he blew into the horn. While we worked, the customer leaned against the bookcase, paging through the book in his hands. Every few moments, he would let out a small giggle or a yelp of recognition at a rediscovered magic trick or a long-forgotten joke. Now, we just need a closer, I said, as we looked over the props we had assembled. A final topper. The kid and I stared at the props, silently willing them to provide the answer we were looking for. The thick silence was broken by the customer.
What about, what do you call it, one of those things, he said, holding the book in one hand and gesturing toward his mouth with the other.
He began to mime, yanking at his mouth, pulling us both into an impromptu game of charades. Taffy, eating spaghetti, wax lips. He shook his head and then quickly flipped through Harry's book, finally finding the illustration he was looking for. A young man pulling a seemingly endless paper streamer out of his mouth.
A mouth coil, I shouted, feeling like I'd just won something. A streamer mouth coil!
I moved behind the counter, trying to remember where we kept them and hoping we hadn't run out.
That will be great, the kid said, beaming. I'll let the audience know that the bell is finally empty, then blow into the tuba one last time. I'll still get a horrible sound, and then I'll start pulling the streamer out of my mouth. That will kill! Thanks!
He looked over at the customer, who was still paging through the book as he walked away from us. The customer looked up, realizing that the compliment had been directed at him.
No problem, he said to the kid. Then he looked at me. If it's okay, I'll take this book, he said. I had one as a kid. Loved it. Really loved it.
Is that all you need? I asked slowly. He smiled down at the book.
Yeah, this will do. But, he added, patting his pockets, I forgot my wallet.
That's okay, I said, gesturing toward the 793.8 sign over the bookcase.
Remember, this is Harry's lending library.
Great, he said, as he looked back at the book, flipping the pages happily.
Thanks a lot.
He opened and closed the door, his attention still focused on reliving the memories the book was providing. I breathed a deep sigh, but my reverie was short-lived.
Boy, this looks like a lot of stuff, the kid said slowly, scanning all the items on the counter. I don't think I can afford all these props.
Not to worry, I said, gathering them up and starting to load them into a brown paper sack.
On occasion, the lending library concept also extends to magic props, I lied. And this is one of those occasions.
Really?
He clearly couldn't believe his good luck. For my part, neither could I.
Really,
I said as I walked him to the door. Come back after the show and let me know how it went.
And return the props.
Yes,
I agreed, having already forgotten that caveat in the sudden flurry of feelings of relief. I saw him out the door and turned to head back to the register, where the small bag the last customer had brought still sat by the open cash drawer. I flashed back to that moment. Was it only 10 minutes ago, when he had first thrust it at me, demanding the contents of the cash drawer,
poking what he said was a gun from the pocket of his worn army jacket. I looked down, wiping at the rivulets of sweat that had been running continuously down the back of my neck. Most of the contents of the cash drawer were already in the bag, as he had demanded. The other half was positioned on top of the drawer, ready to follow their compatriots. I was about to put all the money back into the cash register when a thought occurred to me. I stepped back to the shop's front door and locked it, turning the deadbolt as well for good measure. And before I returned to sort out the mess at the cash register and calm my racing heart, I also had the presence of mind to do the one thing I wished I had done 30 minutes earlier, or an hour, or right away this morning before that first or last customer walked through my door. I flipped the sign in the front window with such force that I nearly pulled it off its string hanger from open to closed. Because right now, I was many, many things, but open for business was not one of them.
This has been The Last Customer, an Eli Marks short mystery, written by John Gaspard, read by Jim Cunningham. Looking for more Eli Marks? All the books in the Eli Marks Mystery Series are available in audiobook, paperback, hardcover, and ebook formats on Amazon. Or head to EliMarksMysteries.com. That's EliMarksMysteries.com. Produced and engineered by Alberts Bridge Books at Grass Lake Studios. Text copyright 2018. Recording copyright 2019. All rights reserved. And thanks for listening.
Well, there you have it. A couple of good reads by a couple of good guys, and these are completely different. One directed more towards young adults or young children, and the other one, it's not really a child's book where that, you know, it's large lettering and photos and everything or illustrations. It really is for young readers. And the other, of course, is for those of us who are lovers of mysteries, both completely unique. And also, I want to give a big thank you both to Greg Korn and to John Gaspard for taking the time to talk with us about these two books, and also particularly to John for allowing us to have this exclusive listen to the short story of The Last Customer. Thanks, John, and thanks to Jim Cunningham for reading that also. Now, I said at the beginning of this podcast that we were going to be announcing the contest and towards the end, so now's the time. If you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there in this week's blog, you will see a place where that you can enter the contest, and by doing that, I'll tell you what I think I'll do is I'm going to have two different entry forms. One is going to be for the memory trap, and the other one will be for the zombie ball, because that way that if you are interested in one but not the other, there won't be any problem. So if you will enter into the contest, the whichever one, or if you'd like to, let me just say that, yeah, you can enter in both if you wish. However, that if you win one, then and your name happens to be randomly drawn in the other contest, that you'll only be awarded one of the two books, not both, if you happen to be one of the extremely lucky ones in that lottery. So go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll find those entry forms. Just fill that out, and then Bob's your uncle. There you go. And hopefully you'll be the winner of one of those. What's great is Greg is giving us not one, but five ebooks, and John is giving us three of the zombie ball then also. So there are eight ebooks in total that will be awarded as prizes. So you have a pretty good chance at winning something. And because that this is going to be an ebook, and you'll be sent a link to the book, that you can download onto your Kindle, and that's an easy app that you can install for free on your smart reader, that this can be available to anybody wherever you are in the world. So as long as you can read English, this is available to you wherever you are worldwide. So I think that's going to be a wrap here for this week. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to keep your priorities straight, and that means family first. This is Scotty out.